Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, and students of Hitler's Table Talk, to episode 12 of the Dinner Table Conversations by the German Führer, as taken down by legal aide Heinrich Heim between 1941 and 1944. Tonight's program covers from midday October 30th to probably November 2nd, 1941. I'm Carolyn Jaeger.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And once again, I want to remind listeners that this show is scheduled for 90 minutes, but we won't necessarily go that long. I'm expecting us to get through the 2nd November midnight conversation. So are you you ready to do that much tonight, Ray?
Absolutely.
Well, if you want to have anything to say before we get started, and then you just go ahead and start.
Okay. Well, I can... Are you ready for me to start reading for the 30th of October?
Yes. I'm still okay. I'm hearing that little bit of a noise, but it's not as bad as it was. It's kind of quiet. It's a rumbly kind of thing in the background. It's funny that as soon as we went on the air, it started up again where I wasn't hearing it at all before while we were talking. So
maybe the enemy is jamming us with shortwave or something.
Well, I just don't know. I hope it won't be. I always hear things more clearly in these earphones of mine than you hear it on the program. So if there is some background noise tonight, I do apologize, listeners. We're doing our best to figure out what this is. It's not something that's always here. It's something that comes and goes, and it's hard to determine. If you don't have anything more that you want to say, any introductory remarks, we can just get started.
That right off the bat, the listeners are going to see that Hitler's use of sarcasm regarding hunting is very prevalent. Then he rips into the bureaucracy and, he defines how it works and the weaknesses of it. Just kind of generally what we're going to cover on this stretch. 30th of October, 1940.
Okay, let me say, I forgot that I do have a timeline thing.
Okay.
And it's pretty important because on this day of 30 October, 1941, Roosevelt approved a $1 billion lend-lease aid to the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to find that these timeline things are kind of follow along this warlike attitude of Roosevelt. All on these few days here, and it's the end of October, November. He's not waiting until December 8th until he's attacked. He already knows what's going to happen, doesn't he? And he's
right.
Preparing lots of things.
And
anyway, $1 billion that back then in 41, $1 billion in aid to the Soviet Union.
Right, and somewhere, I didn't look up the exact date, Carolyn, but somewhere right in this era also, in this month, Churchill and Roosevelt issued that Atlantic Charter, which was a unification that each would help the other out as much as they could, and they wanted to keep Britain alive and things like this. So that's Roosevelt jumping in, meddling. And, of course, the America First Committee was very active in trying to expose all that stuff and to keep us neutral.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, so that's the background.
All righty. Let's go to the 30th of October, 1941, midday. The feeling of aversion human beings have for the snake, the bat, and the earthworm perhaps originates in some ancestral memory. It might go back to a time when animals of this nature, of monstrous dimensions, terrified prehistoric man. I learnt to hate rats when I was at the front. A wounded man, forsaken between the lines, knew he'd be eaten alive by these disgusting beasts. Then it says, the Führer turned to Gruppenführer Wolf, who had returned from a shooting party in the Sudetenland held for Count Ciano by the Minister of Foreign Affairs with the participation of the Reichsfuhrer SS and the Finance Minister.
Yeah, now, Wolf is spelled W-O-L-F-F.
Correct.
And for anybody who wants to look him up, he was a member of Hitler's kind of private entourage or private aides and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And the Minister for Foreign Affairs was von Ribbentrop,
mm-hmm.
at that time, and I guess he liked hunting. And the finance minister was von Krosigk, that fellow I talked about. I don't know if it was on this program or another program now, but I did talk about him quite a bit a week or two ago in relation to something, him being a part of, it was a part of the Flensburg government. It was a different program. He was a part of the Admiral, who's that Admiral, Ray?
I'm trying to think. Carl Dönitz?
Dönitz, yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, he was in the Dönitz Flensburg government, von Krosigk. He was played an important role there. So these are the people.
Yeah, excuse me. The Reichsführer SS mentioned here got to be talking about Himmler.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so that's that group that he's talking about. The Führer, what did you shoot? Eagles? Lions? Wolf?
Now, he's being, sarcastic here.
Yes.
He's being ironic or funny, funny.
Yeah, and this is his put down of hunting.
Yeah.
And Wolf says, no, common rabbits. The Führer, joy must now prevail amongst the rabbits. The air has been cleared. General Jodl, and you list all that game under the heading of wild animals? Wolf, yes. Jodl, wouldn't it be more appropriate to call them domestic animals? The Führer, I expect you used explosive bullets. Wolf, merely lead. The Führer, did you kill or wound any beaters?
Now, the beaters would be, I think, the people who
they
hire to scare the game out of their hiding
place.
They
go beat the bushes to chase the rabbits out.
Yeah.
Wolf, you know, he was a Führer, asked, did you kill or wound any beaters? And Wolf says, no, not to my knowledge. The Führer, a pity. We can't use you crack shots against the Russian partisans. Wolf, the Minister for Foreign Affairs would certainly accept that invitation to take part in a commando. The Führer, what was Ciano's bag? Wolf, 400. The Führer, only 400? If only in the course of his life as an airman he'd shot down even a tiny percentage of that total in enemy aircraft. Your shooting party came to an end without more slaughter than that? Wolf, shooting's a wonderful relaxation. It makes you forget all your troubles.
Let me interfere here.
Yeah.
Because this Ciano is an Italian, of course.
Yes.
So he was Mussolini's son-in-law, and he always had important positions. And so I guess he was up there visiting, and they took him on a hunting party. But Wolf is like playing straight man to Hitler's Hitler's fun and games here that he said he's going through.
This is true.
Yeah.
Wolf has said, shooting is a wonderful relaxation. It makes you forget all your troubles. The Führer replies, is it indispensable for relaxation to kill hares and pheasants? The joy of killing brings men together. It's lucky we don't understand the language of hares, H-A-R-E-S. They might talk about you something like this. He couldn't run at all, that fat hog. What can an old hare with a whole lifetime's experience think about it all? The greatest joy must prevail amongst the hares when they see that a beater has been shot. Jodl, a man needs diversion. He can't be deprived of it, and it's difficult in that field to set bounds to his fantasy. The important thing is that he should enjoy himself without doing harm to the community.
So Jodl's standing up for the hunters.
Yes.
You know, these men need to go out there and do that.
The Führer, for 2 or 3 years they've been preserving foxes. What damage they've caused. On the one hand, they're preserved for the sake of the hunter, which means a loss of I don't know how many 100 million eggs. And on the other hand, they make a 4-year plan. What madness. So what he's talking about right there, of course, is foxes are eating the hen eggs and everything. And he says when they adopted a program to protect the fox because its numbers were dwindling, then doggone if those foxes didn't turn around and eat 100 million eggs. So, and now they've made this 4-year plan. What madness. So he
4-year plan to help the economy.
Yes.
But at the same time, they preserve foxes who do so much damage just for the sake of the hunters.
Yeah.
Well, it sure is clear that Hitler always made it clear he didn't care for hunting. He didn't like so many things that most men generally like.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, you know, sort of, I guess you might say, above all
That's
that.
Exactly the right word.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now we move into the 30th of October, 1941, evening. Under the name of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we are supporting an organization, one of whose functions is to keep us informed.
Well, maybe you better read that thing
paragraph,
because
right.
that's
right.
part of
yeah.
it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The ripping of the bureaucracy here. Okay. The Minister of Foreign Affairs has just submitted to the Führer a report sent in by a representative of the Wilhelmstrasse in a foreign country. The report consisted of a strongly worded account of the situation in England, but without disclosing whether it represented merely views held by the English opposition and reported by the German diplomat, or gave his own comments on the subject. The Führer was speaking to Minister Huell, Ribbentrop's representative with the Führer. Under the name of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we are supporting an organization, one of whose functions is to keep us informed of what is happening abroad, and we know nothing. We are separated from England by a ditch 37 kilometers wide, and we cannot find out what is happening there. If one studies the matter closely, one realizes that the enormous sums swallowed up in the ministry are sheer loss. The only organization to which we grant foreign currency, the others are paid only in paper, should at least get some information for us. By definition, the diplomat is such a distinguished being that he does not mingle with normal beings. As for you, you're an exception because you're seen in our company. I wonder in whose company you'd be seen if. This attitude is typical of Carrier? Diplomats move in a closed circle. Therefore, they only know what is said in the society they frequent.
Yeah, and that means a career diplomat, I'm sure. Kind of French word for it or something.
When someone talks big to me about a generally held opinion, I don't know what he means. One must separate and analyze the current rumors. In addition, one must know the opinions held by one group or another in order to appreciate the relative value of these elements of information. Few people can foretell the development of events, but what is possible is to give information concerning the opinion of such and such a group, or that other. In your trade, you measure people by the height of their heels. If one of our diplomats were to put up at a third-class hotel or travel in a taxi, what a disgrace. And yet it could be interesting sometimes to sit at the bottom of the table. Young people talk more freely than the mandarins. I'm going to stop right there for a second.
Good.
Because I'll never forget a lesson in high school from the best teacher I had about history. And he was talking about why the communists had made such progress in North Vietnam and Korea, how the Russians were looked upon favorably. And he said one of the main reasons was because the Russian diplomat rode a bicycle, shopped amongst the unwashed, so to speak, and the American representatives rode around in limousines, distancing themselves from the common people. And this is exactly what Hitler's saying here about you diplomats ought to mix and mingle with people you can learn something from. And as he said, it could be interesting sometimes to sit at the bottom of the table. Young people talk more freely than the mandarins. And that's what he's alluding to.
Oh, well, yeah, the bottom of the table means get away from all the elites.
Yes.
You know, and he's complaining here that that his foreign service, his diplomats, and how they are, they want to live in luxury. They
yes.
only want to associate with the top class people, and they don't really know what's going on. And he's saying, I'm not getting the information that I'm paying for. You know,
yeah.
a lot of money goes into this foreign office, and what are we getting from it? He's balling them out a little bit.
That's exactly right.
And Huell is the number two guy under Ribbentrop.
Yes.
Oh, no, he's not that.
It says here representative. He's Ribbentrop's representative to the Führer.
To Hitler. Yes. Right. Right. So
yeah.
he's around all the time.
And then when Hitler says that to him, Hugo replied, "But my Führer, all of that's out of date now. You defend your shop with a devotion worthy of admiration. Why support such a numerous staff at the legations? I know what diplomats do. They cut out newspaper articles and paste them together. When I first came to the Reich's Chancellery, I received every week a file stuffed with old clippings. Some of them were a fortnight old. Via Dr. Dietrich, I knew already by the 2nd of July what the Ministry of Foreign Affairs were going to tell me on the 15th. An up-to-date legation should include, above all, half a dozen young attachés who would busy themselves with influential women. It's the only way of keeping informed. But if these young people are sentimentals in search of a sister soul, then let them stay at home. We had a fella, a man named Ludicky, who'd have made a first-rate agent for critical spots, Iran, Iraq. He spoke French, English, Spanish, Italian like a native. He'd have been the man for the present situation. Nothing escaped him. When I think of our representatives abroad, what a disaster they are. Our ambassador to the King of the Belgians was a timid soul. To think that there was nobody in all this ministry who could get his clutches on the daughter of the former American ambassador, Dodd, and yet she wasn't difficult to approach. That was their job, and it should have been done. In a short while, the girl would have been subjugated, meaning they could find out information from her. She was, but unfortunately by others. Nothing to be surprised at, by the way. How would these senile old men of the Wilhelmstrasse have behaved in the ranks? It's the only way. In the old days, when we wanted to lay siege to an industrialist, we attacked him through his children. Old Dodd, who was an imbecile, would have got him through his... We'd have got him through his daughter. But once again, what can one expect from people like that? Keitel inquired, "Was she pretty at least?" Von Puttkamer answered, "Hideous." Hitler continued, "But one must rise above that, my dear fella. It's one of the qualifications. Otherwise, I ask you, why should our diplomats be paid? In that case, diplomacy would no longer be a service, but a pleasure, and it might end in marriage."
Well, he's being funny again, but he's yes. very serious here. And this is really interesting mm-hmm. because it gives some insight into how aware he was of the espionage angle, or not necessarily that, but, you know, the how to get information. It's important for that's what the Foreign Office should be doing, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, being a diplomatic channel and so on. And we learn from this that it's very one of the most common things is to get to people's family members,
sure.
Have some good looking men or you know charming right. men or whatever to get to the women, mm-hmm. and have some good looking. Then they use good women and smart
That's right.
Women to get to the men. And this is just common. And it's going on, and he's saying we had Dodd here and his daughter, and you know. Dodd, when he was American ambassador, his daughter was a young woman, and she was there in Germany the whole time. And I forget all that took place with her, but she was very friendly with Germans, and she, you know, so socialized with them and all of that stuff. And he's saying, "Boy, you really missed the boat there by not
that's right
getting the right person to become friendly to you know
yeah what a
maybe intimate."
Of information that she would have been.
Maybe, you know,
yeah,
been
okay.
something.
Sure.
And then you get at people. I mean, when it comes to this kind of thing, it's pretty cynical. I mean, they're not, nobody's thinking too much about how to be, what, real honorable or something. I mean, it's war, you know. I mean,
yeah.
they go after it. They
use whatever means you can to get the information.
Yeah. And Hitler's perfectly aware of that, and he's telling him that he doesn't think they're doing a very good job.
That's right.
With it because other people are doing it. Mm-hmm. Somebody else got to that Dodd's
yes.
daughter, he says.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, before the next one here is November 1st, some more timeline stuff. And here we have President Franklin D. Roosevelt announces that the U.S. Coast Guard will now be under the direction of the U.S. Navy. And this is a transition of authority usually reserved only for wartime. So once again, you know, he was taken by surprise by what happened with the Japanese. It was a day of infamy. No, he was preparing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go to the 1st of November, 1941 in the evening. It's urgent for economic purposes to work out a statute characterized by the two following principles. Number one, the interests of the state have precedence over private interests. And number two, in the event of a divergence between the interests of the state and private interests, an independent organization shall settle the dispute in accordance with the interests of the German people. The state could not be independent and possess indisputable authority unless those of us who had interests in private undertakings were excluded from the control of public affairs. And the simple fact of owning shares in a private company would be enough. Every person shall have the alternative of giving them up or leaving the service of the state. Servants of the state must not in any way be involved in financial speculations. If they have money, let them buy real property or invest this money in state securities. Thus, their wealth would be bound up with the future of the state. After all, the safety offered by these investments makes them more lucrative in the long run than investments in private industry, which is necessarily liable to booms and slumps. These regulations apply to members of the Reichstag, members of the civil service, regular officers, and the chiefs of the party. These men must be totally unconnected with interests foreign to those of the state. We see what it leads to when laxity is permitted in this field. England would not have slipped into this war if Baldwin and Chamberlain hadn't had interest in the armaments industry. The decadence of the princely houses began in the same fashion.
Now, that's very, very good.
It is.
Very, very good stuff.
Very pertinent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He goes on a little bit more, I think, but you know, he's talking about separating the interests of the state from private interests, and that if you've got private, this is example here, Baldwin and Chamberlain with their interest in the armaments industry. Mm-hmm. And so you can't help but think, you know, start thinking, well, war would, you know, be good for me personally. And this is what we see all the time now currently. I mean, this has been going on in government forever, but we have it right now today. People make tons of money in their investments in the armaments industry via war.
That's exactly right. And, you know, where he says servants of the state must not in any way be involved in financial speculations. And that is to break that tie so that your judgment on critical affairs is going to be for the state, number one, which he says it would be thus in accordance with the interests of the German people.
Yeah, and he wants to have this. He says we have to have it clear that the state, interests of the state take precedence over private interests.
Sure. Okay, we'll move on to the night of the 1st and 2nd of November 1941. Our civil service often commits crude errors. One day, the mayor of Leipzig, Gordeler, came to offer his resignation. The reason was he'd wanted to install electric lighting in a street, and Berlin had been against it. It was obligatory to stick to lighting by gas. I inquired into the matter, and I found that the asinine decision had been taken by a squirt of a lawyer in the Ministry of the Interior. Not long ago, a staff member of the Ministry of Propaganda contested the right of a man who built Munich Opera House to bear the title of architect on the grounds that he did not belong to one or another professional organization. I immediately put an end to that scandal. I'm not surprised that the country is full of hatred toward Berlin. Ministries ought to direct from above, not interfere with the details of execution. The civil service has reached the point of being only a blind machine. We shan't get out of that state of affairs unless we decide on a massive decentralization. Even the mere extensiveness of Reich territory forces us to do this. One mustn't suppose that a regulation applicable to the old Reich or a part of it is automatically applicable to Kirkenes, say, or the Crimea. There's no possibility of ruling this huge empire from Berlin. and by the methods that have been used hitherto. The chief condition for decentralization is that the system of promotion by seniority shall be abandoned in favor of appointment to posts. The former system means simply that as soon as an official has entered into it, he can be moved regularly into higher grades, no matter what his abilities may be. It also means the impossibility of particularly qualified men's being able to skip whole grades, as it would be desirable that they could. As regards salaries, I am likewise of the opinion that new methods should be adopted. The allowance allocated in addition to the basic salary should be in inverse ratio to the number of colleagues employed by the head of a department. This allowance will be all the higher the fewer the aforesaid departmental head's colleagues. He will thus escape the temptation to see salvation only in the multiplication of his subordinates. When we get as far as rebuilding Berlin, I'll install the ministries in relatively confined quarters, and I'll file down their budgets as regards their internal needs. When I think of the organization of the party, which has always been exemplary from every point of view, or the organization of the state railways, which are better run, much to the irritation of Herr Frick, I can see all the more clearly the weaknesses of our ministries. The fundamental difference between the former and the latter is that the former have properly qualified junior staffs. Posts are awarded only with regard to talent, not in virtue of titles that are often no more than valueless pieces of paper. At the bottom of every success in this war, one finds the individual merit of the soldier. That proves the justice of the system that takes account, for purposes of promotion, only of real aptitudes. What indicates an aptitude to the high command is the gift for using each man according to his personal possibilities and for awakening in each man the will to devote himself to the communal effort. That's exactly the opposite of what the civil service practices towards the citizens with regard both to legislation and to the application of the laws. In imitation of what used to be done in the old days, in our old police state, the civil service, even today, sees in the citizen only a politically minor subject who has to be kept on the leash. Especially in the sphere of justice, it is important to be able to rely on a magistrature that is as homogeneous as possible. Let the magistrates present a certain uniformity from the racial point of view, and we can expect the magistracy to apply the conceptions of the state intelligently. Take, as an example, acts of violence committed under the cover of the blackout. The Nordic judge of National Socialist tendency at once recognizes the seriousness of this type of crime and the threat it offers society. A judge who is a native of our regions further to the east will have a tendency to see the facts in themselves, a handbag snatched, a few marks stolen. One won't remedy the state of affairs by multiplying and complicating the laws. It's impossible to codify everything, on the one hand, and on the other hand, to have a written guarantee that the law will in every case be applied in a sensible manner. If we succeed in grouping together our elite of magistrates, taking race into account, we shall be able to restrict ourselves to issuing directives instead of putting ourselves in the straitjacket of a rigid codification. Thus, each judge will have the faculty of acting in accordance with his own sound sense.
Now, I think we should stop here because he's going on into something else next. This is really good. And these are not the words of a tyrant, are they?
No.
From the very beginning, he's talking about reform and responsible and positive reform the civil service and making it more effective so you don't have these people that are just sitting there in their jobs and getting moved up, you know, and not having any imagination and committing what he calls these crude errors, you know, that frustrate people. Because this Wordler, well, he ended up being a traitor, but anyway, he had a position there in Leipzig. He might have been mayor of Leipzig or something. And he was going to quit. Maybe that would have been a good idea. But he was going to quit because of this little problem he had because of some functionary. wouldn't allow him to install electric lighting in his city.
Yeah.
So these kind of things, and he goes all the way from there to with a lot of good ideas, but to individual merit and all of that. But,
sure.
Go ahead.
Well, Carolyn, I think one of the most powerful things about what he's just said is when he says ministries ought to direct from above and not interfere with the details of execution. In other words, tell the people below you and out in the surrounding areas what needs to be done and let them do it because they're close to it. They're close to the people mm-hmm. out there miles away.
Yeah.
A Gauleiter will know more than someone in Berlin, some bureaucrat, saying this is what you're going to do, that needs to be done, and this is how you're going to do it. And he's saying let natural leadership come to the fore and get away from this central adjacent stuff.
And he doesn't like so much codification. That's having
yes.
codes, federal codes for everything.
Yes, explicit laws, you know, and what he's telling you, the people in charge there and the people who have to execute what needs to be done, to have some common sense about them. And don't rely on everything has to be written down or somebody's going to get in trouble. It's a much more natural state of governing.
Yeah, and then what I think was stood out most to me and best was at the last paragraph here where he says that the magistrates need to have a certain uniformity from the racial point of view.
Exactly. That's
and
exactly
he's
right.
saying that really if we have the right racial, if we have people of the same race in, is what the way I take it, they're going to think the same.
Yes.
And then they're going to put out this, you know, similar things. But if you get someone from a different race, like someone from the East, and of course with so often he's talking about Nordic, they're going to see it differently. And he says they'll see the fact, instead of seeing what kind of, that even simple crimes can be very serious to the well-being of the nation, they'll just see the crime in itself, and if it's just a small crime like mm-hmm. someone snatching a handbag, they won't think it's much and not make much out of it, you know. But to the Nordic judge, this is something that can't be tolerated, just this
exactly.
whole kind of thinking that
that's
you go
correct.
Around snatching somebody's handbag. And that's why in the East they've always and still have so much more corruption in the way of bribery and so on. What having to bribe people and so on, because they just don't see it the same way. I'm not going to go into that anymore, but they have a different perspective.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's great that he's saying this here.
Oh, I do too. I mean, it's like he's telling them a code of conduct should come natural to you, and it will if you're racially akin to each other.
Right, right. Exactly. You put that very well.
Okay, so ready to move on here?
Yes,
Okay, the English, one may say, have no constitution. What serves them instead of a constitution is an unwritten law, which lives in each one of them and is established by long usage. The fact of being solidly behind this unwritten law gives every Englishman that attitude of pride on the national level, which does not exist to such a degree in any other people. We Germans, too, must arrive at the result that every judge resembles every other judge, even in his physical appearance. I do not doubt for a moment, despite certain people's skepticism, that within 100 or so years from now, all the German elite will be a product of the SS, for only the SS practices racial selection. Once the conditions of the race's purity are established, it's of no importance whether a man is a native of one region rather than another one, whether he comes from Norway or from Austria. Instead of benches of municipal magistrates and juries, we shall set up the single judge whom we'll pay well and who will be a model and master for young people who aspire to the same rank. What a judge needs is character. A plague of which we could, in any case, free the courts at once is the number of suits for insults. Boy, does that ring true today, political correctness. It could be decreed that such suits cannot be brought until after a delay of from 4 to 6 weeks. the parties would become reconciled in the meantime, and that kind of business would disappear from the rolls. With time, we shall achieve all these things, and others besides.
Isn't that great? You know, I think that last one is quite brilliant. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a good idea. People should not be able to rush to sue somebody for things like insult or whatever. They should have to wait. And if they wait, usually these things settle down and they're not seen as important.
Right. They'll see the ridiculousness of the situation.
Or they'll just say, well, it's not worth going to all this trouble.
Right.
Even if I didn't like it. And so it cut down on a whole lot. I wonder if anybody else has talked about that, and I wonder if that's is a law anywhere. I didn't check into that. I don't know where to look, but I suppose people can file suits whenever they want to, and there's nothing like that I ever heard of.
Yeah, just a statute of limitations. That's of course sometimes two years or 3 years,
And then he wants these judges that he calls magistrates, to be very uniform so that people see them as not as individuals but as somebody representing justice. To me, that's kind of like really blind justice, you know. Wants it to be seen as blind justice, not individuals thinking this way or that way.
That's...
And then he says even if they resemble, even if they all look alike in some way, well, of course, if they all wear their robe and, you know, maybe that was the point of wearing wigs in Britain, to kind of take away their individuality. Not that they wouldn't still have it if they were a corrupt society, but I think those are some good ideas.
Oh, yeah, and see, when he says what a judge needs is character, and what he's saying about the importance of them being so much alike is that anywhere in the realm, no matter where it might be, the average Joe is going to know what to expect if he has to go to court or whatever. He's gonna have a judge that is fair-minded, that is not directed by bureaucratic garbage or whatever. But he will get that treatment no matter where he is, and that's the importance of a uniformity there. That the judge has a high moral character. And is respected so much so that young people are going to be trained in that manner. And that's, you know, so valuable to the country.
That is. That's so good. And, of course, the judges then won't be Jewish.
Yeah.
They won't be Jews. I mean, he's talking about German, people. And what we have, the biggest problem we have with our judiciary is that it's totally so much majority Jewish.
Yeah, in the hands of non-racial kinsmen. And you know, when he says, for only the SS practices racial selection, and because of that, he says within 100 years or so from now, all of the German elite will be a product of the SS. That speaks for itself.
Yeah, I didn't notice that you covered that. I remember it, though. Yeah, that's quite a statement, too, isn't it?
Sure.
Mm-hmm, there it is. I see it now.
So, okay.
Yeah, he says once the conditions of the race's purity are established, it's not going to be important whether, you know, you come from one region or another, even from Norway or from Austria. I mean, that much difference. So, it's his emphasis, and this is 1941, is on still on racial purity as much as is possible.
Oh, sure.
That he thinks is important to have the kind of a good country that he has always wanted to have, you know, for Germans and for any other people doing that.
Stressing racial unity.
Right.
And if you're racially unified in that manner, then it's not going to be a North-South thing. It's not going to be a country-city fight and things like this because you're racially unified. It's going to be based on kinsmanship.
Yes, and he says we're going to achieve all these things and even more.
Sure.
That's so great. What an ending. All right, moving on to November 2nd, 1941 at midnight. There's a timeline for November 2nd. Political conflict in Yugoslavia as leftists under Tito are in competition with the more conservative Serbs under Draža Mihailović. Mihalovich or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Mihalovich is the ones that were allied in some sense with the Germans, and of course Tito
yes.
was a communist.
They were like Cudrinot in Romania.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I wrote something about that had him playing a part in it. But anyway, eventually he was killed, and of course Tito was the big winner in that whole mm-hmm. conflict ultimately. What a butcher.
Right.
All right. Well, that was going on right then on November 2nd. There was some conflict between those two groups then.
Sure. Okay, the 2nd of November, 1941, midnight. Special guest, Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler. In the old Austria, there were two professions for which they used deliberately to select people formerly convicted: customs officers and gamekeepers. As regards smugglers, when sentence was passed, they were given the choice of serving the sentence or becoming customs officers. And poachers were made gamekeepers. The smuggler and the gamekeeper have that sort of thing in their blood. It's wise to offer adventurous natures ways of letting off steam. One man will go into journalism, another will emigrate. The man who remains in the country runs the risk of coming into conflict with the law. The criminal police in Austria was above all suspicion. Just why that was, it's difficult to understand, for the country was quite badly contaminated by the Balkan mentality. Someone must one day have left his personal stamp on the Austrian police, and it was never effaced. My shock troops in 1923 contained some extraordinary elements, men who had come to us with the idea of joining a movement that was going ahead rapidly. Such elements are unusable in a time of peace, but in turbulent periods, it's quite different. At that stage, these jolly rogues were invaluable to me as auxiliaries. 50 bourgeoisie wouldn't have been worth a single one of them. With what blind confidence they followed me. Fundamentally, they were just overgrown children. As for their assumed brutality, they were simply somewhat close to nature. During the war, they had fought with the bayonet and thrown hand grenades. They were simple creatures, all of a piece. They couldn't let the country be sold out to the scum who were the product of defeat. From the beginning, I knew that one could make a party only with elements like that. What a contempt I acquired for the bourgeoisie. If a bourgeois gave me a contribution of 100 or 200 marks, he thought he'd given me the whole of Golconda. But these fine chaps, what sacrifices they were willing to make, all day at their jobs, and at night on a mission for the party, and always with their hearts in the right place. I especially looked for people of disheveled appearance. A bourgeois in a stiff collar would have bitched up everything. Of course, we also had fanatics among the well-dressed people. Moreover, the communists and ourselves were the only parties that had women in their ranks who shrank from nothing. It's with fine people like those that one can hold a state.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
And he says that he's saying that, well, there are also some of these fanatics that he likes that were also amongst the well-dressed people. Mm-hmm. They weren't all not worthless.
Yeah, blue-collar, whatever.
Yeah.
I always knew the first problem was to settle the social question. To pretend to evade the problem was to put oneself in a situation of a man in the 17th or 18th century who pretended it was unnecessary to abolish slavery. Men like Scharnhorst and Nisenau had to fight hard to introduce conscription in Prussia. On the political level, we had to wage a struggle of the same sort. As long as social classes existed, it was impossible to set free the forces of the nation.
You know, on this, I think he means the military elite did not want the common man in their ranks. Is that when he says that Scharnhorst and Nisenau had to fight hard to introduce conscription in Prussia? These were some big military leaders because there are two big battleships named after each one of these men. So they were fighting for conscription, but the Prussian military, which was always super elite, you know, nobility and so on. They wouldn't want that. Why wouldn't they want it? I think because from other things I've read too and studied that they didn't want this to be associated with the common man in their military ranks.
That's right.
And so on. So therefore, if they had only volunteers, they could be selective. And they always thought, I guess, they had enough of them. But Hitler was not an elitist, and that's why he didn't think like them.
Well, that's very pertinent, you know, and it fits exactly the military. But when you also apply that to society with classes, you know, you have the elite, the wealthy, the working man, and if it's divided along those lines, if a country has those classes, they're in conflict with each other, and each other is always out for its own viewpoint, so the country just can't get off the ground. And that's what he says, it was impossible to set free the forces of the nation as long as these social classes existed. That had to be broken down militarily as well as in society.
Yeah, but I just thought it was that people might not understand this.
Yeah.
This one paragraph here because, it was he was talking about, he didn't sit on the political level.
Mm-hmm.
He switched, but he was kind of interesting that he's talking about the Prussian military there.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, now this next sentence, I'm going to read this, and I want to bounce it off of you, Carolyn, because I thought it was, maybe it's not as complex or as unique as I see it, but he says, I never stopped telling my supporters that our victory was a mathematical certainty, for unlike social democracy, we rejected nobody from the national community. Now,
yeah, well, I emphasize national. Mm-hmm. When I read that, I thought, well, what does that mean? And then I thought, well, he says national. So he's talking about the German community. As long as you're German, you're not going to be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you might, if you're a criminal or something, you might be put in prison. But I think then that kind of puts out Jews out of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and the party. I mean, whoever became a member of the National Socialist Party, to me, joined maybe elite is not the right word, but people who were cut above became National Socialists. And to me, there was, you know, you're talking about the paradoxical thing of exclusivity versus inclusion of everybody. But, I think now I see with what you said there, stressing the word national, it does fit up more easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never stopped telling my supporters that our victory was certain because unlike the social democrats, we didn't reject anybody from the national community.
Yeah,
so I don't really know what the social democrats were doing, why he says that. I really don't have an answer to that. But I do know he's saying that we rejected nobody from the national community. So maybe they did. I don't know.
Well, the Social Democrats were, as you know, much more to the left of the National Socialists, and they would reject people who thought like a National Socialist in the way of agriculture or any other. They would reject them because, well, you don't fit social democracy. You're a National Socialist, and exclude them. But, you know.
Oh, then so maybe he's saying, yeah, we accept leftists too.
Yeah, yeah.
We accept everybody.
Yeah.
And they were after the leftists and thought they could, you know.
And they did rehabilitate a
bunch
of them.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's probably it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he goes on. Our present struggle is merely a continuation on the international level of the struggle we've waged on the national level. This is a very, very pertinent sentence right there. Let everyone in his own field take care to do his best, with the knowledge that on every occasion we were pushing the best of us forward. That's how a people surpasses itself and surpasses others. Nothing can happen to us if we remain faithful to these principles. But one must know how to advance step by step, how to reconnoiter the ground and remove one after another the obstacles one finds there. If one neglected to appeal to the masses, one's choice would be rather too much confined to intellectuals. We would lack brute strength. Brute strength consists of the peasant and the worker, for the insecurity of their daily life keeps them close to the state of nature. Give them brains into the bargain, and you turn them into incomparable men of action. Boy, now that's some solid stuff right there.
Yeah.
Above all, we must not allow our elite to become an exclusive society.
That's really great there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All of this is very important for how he looked at things.
What he's defining here is the National Socialist Party and what it stood for. And as long as it operated by those principles, nothing could stand up to it.
First, he's saying that we need to push the best of us forward,
mm-hmm.
and we need to be a people that surpasses itself and surpasses others. And, of course, it may be because I was thinking along these lines, but it makes me think of how the others resented it, that you have to be careful. Well, Germany was trying to become better and better, and this started a while back in their economic successes. But then, he says, but one has to know how to advance step by step and reconnoiter and be careful and remove the obstacles. I was thinking he might have been aware of the difficulty, how you make enemies this way.
Mm-hmm.
And because the others are envious of you,
sure.
and are afraid that I can see that you can pass them by, and they don't want that. And this is why I think that Germany was doing this. And so all the others, led by England and the United States, ganged up on Germany. They got all the others on their side.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get better and better and excel, you're going to run into that. You're going to run into the others around you. Deciding they don't like that, and they can get together. They can't beat you on their own. They can gang up on you. And that's what I think happened to Germany.
Mm-hmm. Well, he obviously wanted his party to be a magnet, and it could only be a magnet if it stood for things that were general to most Germans. And that's a unity thing. You had people that wanted to be. They felt pride in National Socialism and what it stood for. And he felt confident in the growth of the party as long as the party held to the principles that he's outlined here.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we must not allow our elite to become an exclusive society. And certainly not.
No, that's right. You couldn't. They didn't want that. He didn't want that. They had to stay connected to the people. They had to be out. They had to have ways to be among the people. They couldn't just sit around like the English elite and look down upon the people of the ordinary British person.
Yeah, sure.
Like the English elite still does.
Oh yeah. Exactly.
And so, he's saying we need these strong brute strength people. We need people ready to fight and people who are close to the state of nature. You can't just get so intellectual and have a bunch of intellectuals sitting around. And boy, that is so true. They don't accomplish anything then. So you need to have this combination going, and you have to respect one another. And that's the whole thing about National Socialism, wasn't it, Ray? That the workers were to be respected. And the so-called working class, they might call it lower class, whatever, all the classes were to be respected and honored for what they did, and sincerely so, not just pretending.
That's exactly right. And, the Germany was rife with political parties back in that time when the National Socialists were trying to accomplish things at the polls that would put their party in power. And you had the Catholic Center Party, you had the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, all of these various parties. Now, the Communist Party, which claimed to represent the working people, the working workers, workers of the world unite, those guys would go in and bust up the meetings, break up the political meetings of the other parties physically, beating people, making any possible adherent afraid to join that party. Now, where the communist met their match was when they tried to break up the National Socialist Party meetings, and they got it handed right back to them. And when those people who had been thinking about or members of the Social Democrat, the Christian Democrat, the Catholic Center Party, when they saw the National Socialists kick these communist butts, and when they came to break up their meetings, the brown shirts were ready for these thugs and worked them over and sent them packing. That's where he's talking about this brute force can be an appealing thing, because people saw that and said, hey, you know what? The commies can't push these guys around. So I want to be a part of this. I don't want to be bullied by these Reds. And that was another magnetic part of Hitler's party.
Yes. Well, so. Right. Well, then there's more good stuff here.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was the end of that, but it's not the end. So
yeah, there's a little bit more here. The son of an official at the fifth or sixth generation is doomed to become a lawyer. There, at least, no more responsibility. So what kind of role can a nation play when it's governed by people of that sort, people who weigh and analyze everything? One couldn't make history with people like that. I need rough, courageous people who are ready to carry their ideas through to the end, whatever happens. Tenacity is purely a question of character. When this quality is accompanied by intellectual superiority, the result is wonderful.
See, this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I thought this one phrase here, what kind of role can a nation play when it's governed by the people who weigh and analyze everything?
Mm-hmm.
He's used that same language when he was talking about how after the Munich putsch and he was in prison and the party was in disarray, and he said that it was the women who remained faithful to him. Mm-hmm. While he was in prison, it was the men who started falling away, and because they were weighing and analyzing what their options were and what would happen and what would do it. But the women just had this pure faith. And he's saying, you know, this is the same thing here. He wants people who are just ready to hang on, tenacity, you know, and not think about, well, is this going to be good for me now? Maybe I should move somewhere else. Maybe I should do this or that. That's actually what he means there, and
yeah.
I like that very much.
I did, too, and you know what I also interpreted a lot of that right there to mean is, you know, so much of everyday life and the circumstance is in black and white, and when you start twisting it to, no, there's no black, there's no white here, let's turn it gray. Let's turn it gray. And what they're doing is all of that darn weighing and analyzing everything to where you start to lose contact with reality and the real truth. Something's either this way or that way. Well, no, maybe it's this way. You know, and let's mm-hmm. put it in gray terms, mm-hmm. and there's where you start falling apart. And that's what he's talking about. How can you run a nation or make history with people like that that turn everything gray that's really in black and white?
Okay.
The bourgeois with whom we flirted at the time of our struggle were simply aesthetes. But what I needed was partisans who would give themselves body and soul, men as ready to break up a communist meeting as to manage a gal. In war, it's just the same thing. The commander who interests me is the man who pays with his own hide. A strategist is nothing without the brute force. Better the brute force without the strategist. Intelligence has taken refuge in technique. It flees from situations of utter calm, where one grows fat as one grows stupid. Since private enterprise adapts itself to the same evolution, nowadays the heads of firms are nearly all former factory hands. One might arrive at the following paradoxical situation: an administration composed of cretins and private firms capable of forming brain trusts. Thus, to maintain their role, the officials, for lack of intelligence, would possess only the power they obtain from their functions. A military unit needs a commander, and the men never hesitate to recognize the qualities that make a commander. A man who is not capable of commanding usually feels no wish to do so. When an idiot is given command, his subordinates are not slow to make his life a burden. if Germany has never had the equivalent of the French Revolution, it's because Frederick the Great and Joseph II once existed. The Catholic Church makes it a principle to recruit its clergy from all classes of society without any discrimination. A simple cowherd can become a cardinal. That's why the church remains militant. In my little homeland, the bishop, 100 years ago, was the son of a peasant. In 1845, he decided to build a cathedral. The town had 22,000 inhabitants. The cathedral was planned to hold 23,000. It cost 28 million gold crowns. 50 years later, the Protestants built their largest church in the state capital. They spent only 10 million.
Well, do you understand that?
You know, I tried to see which way he was going with that and who he was frowning upon. And, you know, I took it that the Protestants, you know, there at the end where he says 50 years later, the Protestants built their largest church in the state capital and they spent only $10 million. And to me, he was talking about those people back there with their approach wasted so much. You know.
Yeah, but then he says the Catholic Church recruits its clergy from all classes of society, which he's saying, I thought he was saying that that was good.
Yeah, me too.
Without any discrimination. Maybe not. I mean, he says a cowherd can become a cardinal.
Yeah.
That's why the church remains militant. So I thought, you know, he's talking about people with brute strength and common people and so on.
It was a
what they bring. And so that's, he would say that was, that was good. So then he talks about this bishop who was the son of a peasant, and he built a cathedral, and it cost 28 million gold crowns, but 50 years later, the Protestants built one for less.
Now I can see that. I see that in a different light right now, just looking at it. I think he's more proud of these. Back in 1845, they decided to build a cathedral, and the town had 22,000. Well, they built a cathedral that would hold 23. And what he's talking about there is they were forward-looking enough to allow for growth, and that they felt like that they were going to attract more people. And, yeah, they may have spent 28 million gold crowns, but then 50 years later, these Protestants come in and build their largest church, and they spent only 10 million.
Okay, so their church didn't build it large enough.
Yeah, yeah.
It was their largest church, but it wasn't large enough.
Right, yeah. How about that?
Well, that's what it seems like, because he would always say that don't worry about the money. You know, he was ready to spend money and on these great building projects and things. And people would be saying, criticizing, oh, you're spending all that money on building an art museum or something. And he'd wave that away, you know, and say, this is going to be worth it. You know,
sure.
It's important and so on. So he didn't like to fuss over money too much, you know, in that way of being so frugal that you didn't do much. You know, you didn't do things as well as you could do them.
Sure.
Well, I think we handled that puzzle quite well.
I think so, too. Congratulations, partner.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, I like this where he says Germany didn't have a French Revolution because it had Frederick the Great and uh-huh. Joseph II, who were both people, leaders, I mean, that the people loved and liked and respected.
That's
and
right.
They weren't the kind of leaders that the French had at that time. And, of course... Well, we know the Jews played a big part in the French Revolution.
Sure.
And I guess Frederick the Great and Joseph II were not that, didn't allow that to happen. I know Joseph II had a long, long reign.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the longest. He did a lot of good things.
Yeah.
Well.
You know, they didn't have their French Revolution, meaning a slaughter of the elite and anarchy that accompanied that revolution.
Oh, good.
See.
Slaughter of the elite. That's good. That's right. Because the elite were not did not inspire so much hatred amongst the people. But of course, the French Revolution was phony.
Yes, right.
But they were able to convince enough people that
yes.
That they were getting a raw deal and they should join in with that. What a horrible thing that was.
But,
Boy,
that's,
talk
yeah,
about slaughter.
they should have flown the hammer and sickle inside the Star of David, you know, as their flag.
Yeah.
Because that's what it was.
Well, okay, I think we're going to end here, don't you think, okay, Ray?
That'd be fine. There's some great stuff coming up, so I want to tell everybody that's listening tonight to be sure and join us next week because, boy, there's some really, really good stuff coming up where Hitler discusses nutrition, the causes of cancer, all the way from there to the Jews, and, boy, does he analyze them. You talk about wisdom. You don't want to miss that.
Yes, it's very good, very good. So we're signing off now. This is Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour for May 29th, 2014. And we thank you for listening. So for Ray and I, good night.
Good night, folks.